High school sports reporter with Scorebook Live, and this is Scorebook Live Today, a podcast covering prep sports and the people who play them across the state of Washington, or I guess perhaps this week, the people who are not playing them. I'm joined, as always, by the usual suspects, analyst, columnist, former NBA player Dan Dickow in Spokane, and a fellow reporter Todd Millis in Tacoma. How you guys doing? What's keeping you guys busy?
What's keeping me busy is start of school over in Spokane. Some of the schools started yesterday, some today, and the rest next week.
Yeah, you know what's keeping me busy.
Boy, football.
Football preview.
Hey, I will say this. Your guys' football preview on Scorebook Live Washington has been off the charts good. I've had so many people mention that the coverage of every league and every team has been very well received, and they're excited about it. So I just want to congratulate you two on such a job well done.
Well, we're excited to get this season rolling. I know, you know, as the time when we're recording this, I just uploaded the last 3A preview, and we'll get our top 10 up soon. And Todd is just coming to a close on 4A, so Scorebook Live Washington is going to be your place for a comprehensive statewide football previews. So, but today on this podcast, at the top, we're going to talk about attendance in high school sports being down for the first time in 30 years, according to a new annual study. And then we're going to take a look at the new play clock rule coming to Washington high school football. And finally, we're going to give a sneak peek at SB Live's 3A football top 10 preseason rankings, which are set to go public on Friday. So attendance in high school sports for the first time in 30 years is down, according to a new study by the National Federation for High School State Associations. The last time the attendance for participation in high school sports, I should say, the last time it declined was in the 1988-89 school year. Just a fascinating look, and big data nerds would be a huge fan of this. But what does this mean? Does this surprise you guys that that we're seeing, you know, not only in certain isolated sports, but just overall across the board, attendance being down across the nation, and particularly in Washington?
Well, I think the couple things that jump out to me as far as participation, you know, granted, I've been out of high school now for, I'm dating myself a little bit over 20 years, but there were a lot of multi-sport athletes when I was growing up. Many of my best friends were multi-sport athletes. I played two sports my first 2 years until I just decided to focus on basketball. But unfortunately, in this day and age, there's so much pressure from the AAU basketballs and the travel baseball teams. And, now you're 7-on-7 that's becoming very prevalent. There is some pressure, by those programs, but there's also a lot more pressure by the parents these days that they want their kids to pick earlier so that they can maximize their opportunity to get a college scholarship. And that, to me, is frightening and scary when that's the case. If you're good enough, I think cross-training or training in multiple sports is important to kind of broaden your horizons and improve your athleticism while you're growing up. I think that's a shame.
Yeah, this report there were a few things that kind of hit me about this, Andy. The first one was, the stat was a little misleading, the fact that it's the first decline over a year. And we're coming off an all-time high participation the year before. So to me, that's, are kids quitting high school sports? No, I didn't feel like the decline was so steep that I felt like it was troublesome. Now, football, yeah, and we've had a lot of coverage about concussions and the safety of football, and I think, you know, that's obviously at the forefront of one sport. But I think people what the numbers of this report do back up is that maybe some of these football players, you know, are finding an outlet in different sports like lacrosse. Lacrosse is on the rise. Lacrosse is on the rise in the state of Washington. It's always been prevalent in California and Colorado and back east, and now we're starting to see a rise here in participation. Soccer is another one. I mean, with the attention with MLS and more people paying attention to what's going on in Europe, that doesn't surprise me. So I think people are just picking which physical nature sport they want to sort of participate in. They're a little more choosy about where they're going. The part of this study that surprised me that I really want to hear from Dan on is the decline in basketball, both in girls and boys, a sport that's equally popular in urban areas and suburban areas. You know, we've heard about how the girls, that the sport has really improved on the girls side even in the last 5 years. To see that participation is down on both sides in basketball was probably the most shocking thing about this report. And I'd like to hear Dan, you know, some thoughts about Dan from Dan about that.
Yeah, I think that is shocking because, you know, obviously I think basketball is still a growing sport as far as interest, not only, you know, in the U.S., but worldwide. But I think the reason maybe some of these participation numbers, and in particular basketball, slightly dipped is, you know, the budgetary constraints that many school districts and schools now have. You know, I remember back when I was in high school, we had four teams. We had varsity, we had JV, we had C team, we had freshmen. I hear a lot of schools these days literally have two teams. You have a varsity that, for unfortunate reasons, many people know before tryouts even who those 10 to 12 kids are going to be. And then you have, you know, either a JV or a freshman team depending on what that program fields that year. So I do think those numbers are a little bit misleading because I think part of those are because of budgetary, you know, restrictions and constraints.
Sure, and that's an important distinction. It's not like the numbers, you know, have started to crater as if you just read the headline, it might connote. But yeah, no, I mean, you know, football and basketball being the top sports, there were some interesting comments by Dr. Carissa Niehoff, who's the executive director of the NFHS. And basically, you know, she just, you know, says, and I quote, "The data from this year's survey serves as a reminder that we have to work harder in the coming years to involve more students in these programs, not only athletics, but in performing arts as well." Todd, it's an interesting point you made about lacrosse and some sports, and lacrosse by no means is a non-contact sport. I mean, but it's something that when you see the decline in football and the increased awareness around injuries in football and measures in injury prevention, that it certainly doesn't, it shouldn't come as a surprise that that less sports with less contact like lacrosse or even no contact like cross country was up. Those types of things, that there's been more of a trend. Moving on, we're going to go to onto a topic that Todd, you will be able to kind of discuss at length. You recently attended a meeting with coaches and officials up in the Puget Sound area, the South Puget Sound area. Is that right? Do you want to kind of let us in on the meeting you attended?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of for all you rules nerds out there that need to know every rule in the football handbook. And there were a few things that were discussed, and I'll go over some of the minor ones that you know, just if fans are in the stands and they're saying, "Hey, that person doesn't have his hand all the way inside the, you know, that where the shoulder pads at, that's not a horse collar." Well, you know, they changed the scope of the horse collar rules, so now they've extended it to the jerseys. So those are some of the minor rules modifications taken from some of the stuff that's done and approved at the national level. But the one that seems to be the biggest concern, and just the mechanics of it, has very little to do with football. It's It's what happens in between plays, and it's the play clock. And I know I've been in this press box. I'm sure Dan's been in the football stands, and you've been on the sidelines. Sometimes you just wonder how that clock got to 5 seconds and the ball hasn't even been placed yet. So there are more definitions of what constitutes a 40-second clock reset and a 25-second clock reset. The 40-second clock play clocks are anything happen after any dead ball inbounds. That's an incomplete pass. A fumble that's been ruled, a penalty. Anything that's been thrown out of bounds is the same thing, goes to a 40-second play clock. Anything after an interception, a double change of possession. I don't know if you guys know what that is. That's kind of like if the defense intercepts a ball and then fumbles it back to the offense. You rarely see that in football, but after a double change of possession, that's when the 40-second clock rule is invoked, and after a first down. So those are kind of the guidelines for 40-second rules. Now, the mechanics of 40-second rules, especially in a hurry-up offense, that's going to be the hard part, and I think that's going to create the most stress between officiating crews and coaches, because a lot of these hurry-up offenses want the ball to be down, place, and they can go. Now, you know, officials and ball boys and whatnot are human too. They're not professional. So it's going to take them a little longer to get up, get the first down marker up, all the stuff that we just sit there and take for granted. You know, it takes a collective effort to get organized. And so these officials have basically said, hey, our goal is to have the football placed in a 40-second play clock reset by the 33-second mark. Now that's, you think about that, 7 seconds from the time a play ends and is reset to the time where they're going to have a ball ready for snap is 7 seconds. I think that's ambitious. I think this is going to cause a lot of problems with sidelines and referees throughout the season. Now, I'm glad that the fish, you know, I was there with two directors of officiating crews in the Puget Sound area. I'm glad that they're trying to get ahead and get it to these coaches association meetings and explain what the philosophies are, what the rule changes are, and what they're going to try and do. This is the early part of the season. I think this is something that we're going to all go and we're going to all watch. Us rules nerds are all going to watch and go, okay, you know, this game feels discombobulated. It feels like it's on a delay, but it's going to be interesting to see how the mechanics improve throughout 2019 and beyond, because right now the coaches have been forewarned, and to me, it's the biggest rule adjustment and change I think we've seen here in the last few years.
Are tensions going to rise between coaches and officials, do you feel like? And kind of what are those relationships like anyways? I mean, how much contact do coaches and officials have, outside the in-game format?
Well, I the good thing about having an officials association representative in with a coaches meeting is they can probably air out some differences that you normally don't get to, you know, before a game or at halftime or at the end of the game. I think in a large part, these coaches feel like, you know, they track some of the questionable calls and they monitor it and they log it and they send it to the officials association or to the WOA. And they feel like it just sort of gets lost in midair. And they wonder, what am I doing? Why am I wasting my time, you know, filling out, assessment forms if nothing changes? You know, listening to both sides kind of talk about their frustrations with the other, the major thing that came out of this is the lack of communication. I think that drives both parties crazy. I think when officials don't want or don't give time to coaches to explain something, or hey, if I have a question or I want a rules interpretation, if they sort of get shut down, that's the start of a bad night between coaches and officials. And it's the same thing with some officials. I know some officials that try and go to coaches and say, hey, you know, do we have a problem here? Can we get through this? there are coaches out there that go, yeah, we have a problem and it's not going to get solved tonight. So the theme I was hearing between both parties is let's try and keep this communication line working for four quarters or in a basketball game for four quarters. Dan, you can probably kind of, you know, you've been around officials playing and some of your coaching stuff. I mean, how hard a relationship is that to keep and to, you know, from both sides to maintain?
Yeah, it's a delicate balance, especially at the youth and high school level, because, you know, officials at those levels are not making the amount of money a college or a professional official is making, and they're doing it to give back to their community. They're doing to because they love the particular sport that they're officiating. So I would hope and I would think that, you know, coaches and fans and players would give them a little bit of a break. But what I've always learned is, as a player, if you give an official respect and understand, hey, they missed a call, and they probably know they missed a call. And when you go to them with respect and you ask a question, hey, what did you see in that situation? What did you see? Was it a foul on me? Was I out of bounds? Many times you'd be surprised to hear this. An official will be absolutely honest. Hey, I apologize. I missed that call. I'll do much better on the next one. And that you're not going to maybe get the next one that isn't quote unquote questionable. But what you're going to get is empathy from an official, and you're going to get an honest response for the most part from an official that they're going to give you their best shot. And that is a player, that is a coach, is all that you're asking for, is that an official gives you their best shot, their best look, their best judgment on any particular call. But again, when a coach, when a player goes up to an official in a non-respectful way, trying to belittle an official, I have a problem with that at any level.
Andy, we talked about this to start the podcast about athletic participation being down, and this is a point that the officials' associations will constantly make because they want to bring new officials in. You know, officials' participation is down at the high school level, and one of the points that they make with coaches that I think is a really valid one is we're getting officials in certain sports, especially football, where it's, you know, 6 to 8, you know, crew members. We're getting people who are new to the sport who probably should be officiating a C team or a JV game, you know, cutting their teeth. But because there's such a shortage in officials, they have to be pressed into duty at a varsity level. So some of these officials, when pressed for answers from coaches, they just don't know the answer. So their first instinct is to just shut it down because I don't want to look not unknowledgeable or dumb. So they either just sort of shut it down or they sort of enforce the rules that they do know. And so that's one thing that I think we need to keep in perspective when we're at a high school football or basketball game, watching these guys, that some of these officials are so new to high level action that they probably need to be cut slack because they should probably be refereeing at a lower level early in their orientation.
That's a great point you made, Todd. And I know in Southwest Washington they're multiple sports, you know, particularly football, basketball, some of the more popular high school sports are being there are shortages at within the official ranks. I was at a three-team scrimmage at in Vancouver in I believe it was June, and sat there and talked to a more experienced official for a while who was his sole purpose at a scrimmage, which was kind of, you know, a pads 11-on-11 scrimmage between three area teams. His sole purpose there was to mentor a brand new official, a younger guy who didn't have much experience and was going to be relied upon, I believe, at the varsity level. So, you know, it's something that it's a trend that we're seeing in addition to, like you said, the attendance or I keep saying attendance, participation in high school sports. And, you know, something that it appears, you know, at least at your meeting, that both parties are being pretty proactive to, you know, keep a strong understanding and a good relationship.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I don't think dialogue is ever a bad thing. You know, it's off-season dialogue. It's a little different than when you're in the heat of the battle, when you're in game, when it's an important call that swings a game. I mean, it's hard to be level-headed in those situations, but it's good to get, you know, it's good to be proactive, to have these two parties get together at league meetings. I hope it happened around the state. I know the legion of coaches that were there were much appreciative of these two heads of the of separate Puget Sound officiating crews and associations to come down and talk and see, you know, where can we make hay and keep these relationships going, because right now it feels delicate. It really does, like you said, with the lack of officials or the shortage of officials. You know, good officials will tell you they do it because they, like Dan said, they do it because they love the love of the game. It's something they can get away and go do. They're not doing it for the money. They're not doing it for the hour and a half drive it takes sometimes to get to football games or basketball games. And I would hate to see good officials be pushed out because, you know, these relationships die. And again, I like this proactive off-season dialogue. Let's hope this continues on into the season.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from a sponsor. After the break, when we come back, we're going to unveil team by team an exclusive look at Scorebook Live's top 10 for the 3A classification in the state of Washington for the upcoming football season. So stay tuned. Washington Federal is a bank based in Seattle that operates 235 branches, and it cares deeply about high school sports not only in the Seattle metro area, but across the entire state of Washington. Head to WashingtonFederal.com to learn more or visit your closest branch.
Class 3A in the state of Washington, in the sport of football, is among the best classes, most competitive classes, and produces the most talent in the state across any sports. At Scorebook Live, we've taken this week to release the 3A team previews and league previews day by day, and getting set to release our top 10. And we thought, you know, why don't we just do it on this podcast? So, Todd, you and I will kind of walk through what the 3A top 10 is going to be for the preseason before a single game is played. And we'll just talk about what each team brings back. So should I just start at 10? Should I start at 1? I mean, I think if anyone who has their thumb on high school football in Washington knows kind of who are the, you know, the top two or three teams are.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a classification where there's two very clear top teams, and there's maybe even now a tier in between those two teams, given what happened in the state championship game last year. But I'm not ready to go that far, because Monty Kohler is someday going to be the winningest coach in state history. He knows how to win big games. So the Eastside Catholic at 1 and O'Day at 2. Eastside Catholic, with all that Division I talent, even though with the new coach, they're starting to put their own tradition together. O'Day's had the tradition. You know, you've looked at the Metro League. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, the state championship last year was Eastside Catholic O'Day, both coming out of the 3A Metro League in the Mountain Division. And Eastside ran over O'Day 31-13. Eastside does have a new first-year coach in Dominic Dasty. He was previously the offensive line coach, but he brings a ton of experience as a coordinator both at the high school and college level. And we've talked about on this podcast before, you know, former Washington High School standout Drew Miller running that offense now, and just all the weapons they bring back, you know, 8 on offense, 7 on defense. And we're talking, you know, high level Division I talent. We're talking G. Scott, Ohio State commit out wide, Sam Adams, a UW commit as a running back, safety, and then, you know, a strong line with
multiple guys over 300 pounds. Jernius Tafia, I believe, is his name. And D'Angelo, I'm going to completely butcher his name, but it's Titali, I believe. And then at tight end, you have DJ Rogers, who's also a highly touted recruit as well. So, you know, that's just the offense. On the defense, you know, you have JT Tumalau, and then, you know, Aiden Hector as a D, as a DB. Both of those guys are going to be Power 5 Division 1 players very soon. So Eastside Catholic is the clear number one. It would be a shock to me that if they didn't repeat. And I think that, you know, while O'Day has the pedigree in its head coach, Monty Kohler, who is entering his 35th year and has accrued over 330 wins over the course of his career, and a lot of state championships at that, I think we have to start with Eastside Catholic. You know, they're going to be playing a nationally competitive schedule. They're playing a team from Arizona and a team from Oregon. And, you know, this is a team that is ranked across the country. This is one of the better high school teams across the country. So, you know, it goes Eastside Catholic number one, it goes O'Day two, and then at three, you have Lincoln of Tacoma out of the 3A Pierce County League, which that's a league that those top three teams are all, you know, all top 10 teams. I mean, they can legitimately they have three teams that can play up with basically anyone in the state.
Yeah, I mean, these three teams have been in this position the last two or, you know, last couple of years. The surprise thing was that none of these teams were able to go very far last year, which was kind of an anomaly. Now, you mentioned Lincoln. Lincoln has the most talent in the league. This is a group that's collected skill position star after skill position star. I mean, and then when you get a few transfers that come in, notably Donovan Clark, who was a, you know, people saw him on TV last year for Sumner, you know, have four interceptions in a game against Camas.
Man, I was there.
Yeah, I mean that's hard to see. That's you don't see that very often in a high school football game. But you add him to a secondary with Jalen Clark and Jedediah Hayes, and you got Julian Simon, who can play a rover position. He can play back and he can play up. You know, that's kind of where it starts with me, is on defense. They're going to be fast. They're going to be ball hawking. You know, they're going to up front. They're not the team that they've been here in the last couple of years, but they've got some real good young talent, especially a few ninth graders. I've seen them. I want to know what labs they're grown in. And then you look on the offensive side, and you have all those guys, you know, that, you know, most of those stars play both ways. And then you have, you know, a quarterback that has some experience. It's Caden Filer. And, He's a young man that has a live arm. He needs to probably learn to manage the game better. You know, the things that are hard for quarterbacks at this level. Just take the check down, throw it to the running back, the short route. You don't always have to go for the big play. You know, that's stuff that he's really, really worked on this summer, according to his coach and his offensive coordinator. So it'll be interesting to see how he manages that offense with so many weapons. If he can just sort of be the guy that sort of gets it going and doesn't need to get all the stats, he's going to get the stats anyway because he has so much talent around him. So, you know, they're the team. You know, they're the team to beat again in the 3A PCL, but they're not the defending champs. That's the Lakes Lancers, and Dave Miller's been there for a long time. He has a real physical group. You know, they used to be Lincoln. And, you know, back in the last 20 years, we used to talk about Lakes like we talk about Lincoln, because they'd have all these D1 kids, Cavario Middleton, Jermaine Kearse, you mentioned Drew Miller, I mean, on and on. I mean, you could, you know, I could do a whole podcast on Lakes D1, you know, athletes. But, you know, it's interesting to see how they, you know, these teams that maybe on paper don't have as much talent as a Lincoln, how Dave's really kind of got them to buy into the cohesiveness and playing together and the chemistry part. And this is a team that that really took it to Lincoln last year, probably gave Misaki his worst loss as a Lincoln coach. And they're physical. They have the best linebacking core in the league. If you don't know, seriously, if you don't know who Devon Nafoa, you know, Meso is, he's a sophomore. He looks like Troy Polamalu. If you don't know who he is now, you're going to know who he is at the end of the year. He's going to be a guy that's going to climb the recruiting rankings very, very quickly, and he leads a very, very good linebacking core. Lakes is going to be fantastic and balanced on defense. If they can get something out of their new quarterback, he's a transfer from Curtis. His name's Justin Brennan. If he can get it to the likes of, you know, Jaden Hall and Devon's going to play running back. I mean, it's a very, very balanced team. And I don't see the gap between Lincoln and Lakes being all that much. I know we have Lincoln 3 and Lakes 5. So I think our rankings reflect that. I think they're the two most complete teams in the league. And then you can talk about Bethel. I mean, Bethel, maybe not as deep as the other two, but I mean, they've got, you know, Will and Peter Latu, who, you know, they're going to be on national TV in week one at Kennedy. You know, Peter Latu is the prototypical safety build. He comes downhill, he hits people, he's athletic. His brother's Will Latu. He plays linebacker. He plays running back. Not as flashy as his brother, but probably a little more disciplined, a little more methodical, you know, a little more of a thinker on his feet. He's a fantastic player, probably their best two-way player. But they've got Cameron Parker, a good receiver. Robert Cooper is a big kid that they have, real important for them because they haven't been able to match up with Lakes and Lincoln across the board the last couple of years in the trenches. And this is a young man that is one guy that can. So while they might not have all the pieces fully that the other two have, they have talent, and you know, talent can be scary, and all they need to do is put that talent together, you know, for a game against those two, and they're right there. So and
certainly, and you know, Bethel's going to be tested early too. I mean, you mentioned that Kennedy Catholic game week one on at CenturyLink on ESPN, and then week two they had O'Day at home. So we're going to learn a lot about Bethel.
Yeah,
right off the bat.
And Bethel was very close in beating O'Day last year in a non-conference game. So this is a team with a lot of ability, but you know, kind of a little less steady than the other two. There are more ups and downs, peaks and plateaus with that team, but certainly scary talent. And Mark Edens is, you know, he's a former quarterback in Montana and a really good up-and-coming coach, and has really done a good job stabilizing that program. So, like you said, there are very few leagues that have a top three like that, and certainly the three PCL should be well represented, you know, late in October and early November.
No question. So just to reiterate our top 10, we go obviously Eastside Catholic 1, O'Day 2, Lincoln 3, and then we go Bellevue 4 out of the 3A Kinko, who I'll come back to, Lakes at 5, Mount Spokane out of the 3A JSL at 6, Peninsula at 7 out of the SSC, Kamiokin, Mid-Columbia Conference team, at 8, Bethel at 9, and then out of the 3A Wesco, Snohomish at 10. And there's certainly, you know, teams in the mix outside of the top 10, you know, who could you know, prove themselves to be top 10 worthy, you know, after, you know, say 3 weeks or after the first few weeks. But going back to number 4, Bellevue. Bellevue, who used to be, you know, obviously one of the most dominant programs in the state, hasn't really, you know, they're back in the mix after a few years. Last year they went to in the 3A state semifinals where the Wolverines lost to Eastside Catholic. It was a drubbing, 41-3. But by getting there, just a really impressive 12-1 season. They, you know, swept the 3A Kinko League. Michael Knipe, a 26-year-old coach who is just a couple years out of college, where he played on the offensive line at UW. You know, he put together – he wasn't just working with a bunch of really good parts last year. Bellevue legitimately won some really tough games. They came down to Camas and came back on campus in the fourth quarter and won at Doc Harris Stadium, a place where you know, not a lot of teams can say they've won. You know, the Bellevue, they beat Central Valley early, and they just made an impressive run and a dominant one throughout the postseason. So this year, Bellevue just returns seven starters. So, you know, they're not going to have the weapons that, you know, a Lincoln, the highly touted recruits that a Lincoln has, or even that a Bethel has. But they've got two really, you know, solid running backs who complement each other in Alex Reed, kind of the quick running back in space, more of the scat back. He was first team all league as a junior. And then Joby Schneider, power back, downhill runner, and someone who's been a 3-year starter. And they've just got leadership. Henry Haublitzel, and, you know, I apologize to Henry for probably butchering his last name, but Knipe could not stop raving about this kid. 3-year starter. He's played. He started at all, you know, six spots on the line. High football IQ, really quick feet. And you know, as our preview states, I mean, he's the unequivocal team leader for Bellevue. So, you know, a team that they're not going to run through the Kinko like they did last year. It's going to be a bit more competitive. Lake Washington's got a really senior heavy team this year, but you know, going into the season, you know, Bellevue is certainly the favorite there, and certainly one of the best teams coming back. Obviously, with you know, it's a school that's won a lot in years past. Going down, you know, you went over Lakes, Mount Spokane out of the 3A Greater St. Helens League. I talked to a coach out there this morning who described Mount Spokane, and this is a regional reference, although I'm sure everyone will understand this. They describe Mount Spokane as the Gonzaga University of the GSL. They're just always good. They just always have the numbers. They've always got talent, and this year's no exception. You know, it's looking for head coach Terry Clore like a really strong year with Jeter Shurman. I mean, we talked about Mount Spokane a bit when we previewed the GSL, but they've got a quarterback that a year ago was the sixth string quarterback at the beginning of last summer, and circumstance led to him being forced to start midseason, and he's really stepped into an important role. But the question for Mount Spokane is, are they going to drop, you know, a game here or there? They lost to Shadle last year, and you know, people over at Mount Spokane will say it was due to injuries. I believe their top running back, Cannon Katzer, was hurt. He'll be healthy this year, at least, you know, they're coming in healthy. But Mount Spokane, we have them at six. I wouldn't be surprised if they put together, you know, if they were higher than that halfway through the season. At seven, we've got Peninsula. Todd, you know, they're coming out of the South Sound Conference. What do you know about Peninsula?
What I know about Peninsula, I feel like they always start the season at this spot. They're as consistent a program as we have in the South Sound. I mean, think of this. Let me just read some numbers. In the last 14 seasons, they've made the state playoffs 13 years. The last 7 years, they've reached the state quarterfinal six times. I mean, you think about that. That's not just a team. That's a program that Ross Philkins has taken a long time to build, and it's one of the true models, you know, in this area. And yeah, I mean, did they lose a lot? Absolutely. When you lose your quarterback to New Hampshire, and you lose your top running back, he goes to Wazoo. You know, those are two important positions to try and fill. But they, you know, they didn't lose a lot. They have eight back on each side of the ball. And Chase Whitmers is a guy I think we're going to find out a lot about. He's a extremely physical H-back, fullback type, you know, and it kind of fits the Ross Philkins way. You know, Ross Philkins was a offensive lineman in high school. He went to Washington State and was a lineman there. He likes physical football. This is his kind of guy, Chase Whitmers. He says in terms of open space blocking, he's as good as he's ever coached in his 20-something years at Peninsula. So they've got him. They've got a tight end in Mason Hyde, who came in as an offensive tackle, but his hands were so good that they said, you know what, let's see if you can move. He's got soft hands. He can move pretty well for a big guy. And then Peyton Bice is their new quarterback. Now, Peyton is the one that came in for Burke last year when Burke got hurt in the state quarterfinal game against O'Day and led him on a touchdown drive. Now, it's a tough situation for a backup to come in, especially against O'Day, who plays really physical discipline type defense. But now having a full offseason, this is the young man that gets the controls. He's waited patiently for 2 years. He's not one who's pouted. He's worked diligently, studying the position. He's had some good mentors, and it's his turn. Now, you always worry about a guy taking over for the first time, but it seems like Peninsula always, you know, these new guys for Peninsula always pass with flying colors, especially a quarterback, because their supporting cast and their infrastructure is so good. I don't expect anything less from Peninsula. I think they're a clear favorite or a more clear favorite in the SSC than they've been here recently. Timberline's given them a run for their money. Yelm had a great year last year. Central Kitsap's a team to look forward to as a sleeper in that league. But right now, going into 2019, Peninsula is clearly the team to beat in that league, and that's and I think that's sort of reflective in our rankings having them at number 7.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned infrastructure, and I look at Kamiakin at number 8 as you know, having a really solid foundation. You know, you start with Scott Biglin entering his 11th season as the head coach there. They won a 3A state title in 2016, and the last 2 years they've been knocked out in the first round. Last year they got, you know, drubbed by O'Day in the first round, 49-7. O'Day is the team that they beat in the state title game in 2016. And they're going to have to answer some similar questions this year, coming into this year, as they did last year. They replaced 4 of 5 on the offensive line, which is going to be the biggest question mark. It's not necessarily guys who have had no experience, but, you know, more so just younger guys who have been rotation guys who have seen varsity snaps that are just going to need to be elevated into bigger roles. Tanner Solon's lineman, he's kind of an undersized D lineman and really is emblematic of a lot of what Kamiakin stands for. He's just kind of a multi-year starter on both sides of the ball, first team all MCC defensive lineman as a junior, and someone who everyone kind of looks to, really centers the line. But Kamiakin's strengths are really going to be in their skill positions. Messiah Jones, nomination for top names in the state, 6'6" receiver, first team all MCC selection last year, had a good breakout season last year as a sophomore. He's a junior, and last season in their loss against O'Day, his season ended after he was, went up for a ball in the air. Defender had a clean hit on him, but he landed on his neck / head, and his season ended with him being carted off in an ambulance. You know, he ended up being fine. It was precautionary. But he's back, and Kamiakin certainly has the talent to make a run farther than the first round. They've got Tuna Altahir, a running back. He's a power back who will just run through defenses. And, you know, one coach in the league very succinctly just goes, yeah, he's a load. And that's why they call him the Big Tuna. So 6'1", 215, junior running back is not someone that I necessarily would want to tackle. I don't know about you, Todd.
Yeah, I'd tackle him with ease. You know, I should, you know, Kennewick should be reaching out to me to see if I have any eligibility. Yeah.
Yeah, you might. Yeah. But, you know, another one of those questions that Kamiakin's going to have to answer is who's going to be starting at quarterback for them? They've got two options in Henry Mercado, a sophomore, and Lucas Castilleja. Both of them are, you know, would be traditionally undersized. Castilleja is 5'7", 165, and Mercado is 5'10", 150. Mercado kind of, he's really closed the gap a bit in the offseason. Castilla's returning starter. So, you know, either way, this is a quarterback battle that Bigland sees. He says he doesn't need to necessarily have answered by week one. So maybe when they open with West Valley at home or go at Southridge, they'll still be able to figure it out before they get into their tough league slate. So,
yeah, I think we talked about this off air about the top 10 rankings and what was different about the state this year. There was so much South Sound representation, and we have Kamaiken. Kamaiken seems to always be in our rankings. Mount Spokane is a team that's been there the last few years as well. The biggest difference for me in the top 10 this year is the fact that we don't have a Ferndale. We don't have a Squalicum. There's no clear-cut 3A Wesco team. And I know we picked Snohomish to fill out our rankings. They have a lot of guys back. They were in the state playoffs last year. We all love Kurt Marsh. I mean, Snohomish, I mean, way back when, was one of the most dominant teams up north and in the state for that matter. So it's good to see a team like that kind of come back to the forefront, and it very well could be the best team in the Wesco this year. We picked them to kind of round out our top 10. But to me, that's the biggest difference, not having a Ferndale, not having a Squalicum, a couple of those real traditional, or at least Squalicum recently here in the last 5 years has been a staple in the state playoffs and whatnot. So, it'll be interesting to see what happens in that 3A Wesco this year.
Yeah, no question. That's a great point. So with Snohomish at 10, I mean, that concludes our 3A top 10 rankings. Todd, I mean, are you happy with these rankings and at least are you happy to are you looking forward to seeing kind of how things shake out with these teams?
Well, I mean, we put a lot of work to try and get this right. Now, we could just, you know, sort of be lazy and flip it. We can make Snohomish our number one team, and we can make Eastside Catholic our number 10 team. How do you think the state would react to that, Andy?
I think people would be picketing the Scorebook Live Washington offices.
Yeah, I think I would be picketing Scorebook Live offices as well. So yeah. No, I think like we said at the outset, you know, the top two teams are pretty clear, and after that, you can kind of rearrange them however you want, because they're that second and third tier. There's going to be a lot of movement within those two tiers throughout much of the season. But at the end of the day, if it's anybody but O'Day and Eastside Catholic, obviously seeds wise, you know, let's hope that they're on the opposite ends. But if it's anybody but those two teams playing for a state championship, I think I'd be mildly surprised, to put it mildly.
If you think, if you have any takes on if you think we got anything wrong, if you think we got anything right, for once, hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Andy Bueller. Todd's at Many Hats Millis. We are always at SB Live WA. Let us know what you think. We'd love to. We'll be happy to highlight any comments on next week's podcast. And to get next week's podcast, why don't you go ahead and subscribe on Apple Podcasts? Search Scorebook Live today and hit that subscribe button. It's free. Episodes download each week when they come out on Thursdays. You got Apple Podcasts, Spotify, if you use that, Google Play, Stitcher. Anywhere you get podcasts, you can find us. So be sure to do that. And thanks for listening. We will look forward to talking to you next week.